The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Tuesday, September the 9th. I'm Belinda Rhodes. On today's podcast, a Guardian survey of Conservatives who hope to win seats at the next election sheds light on what the reborn Tory party is all about.
You have a Conservative Party that's ideologically predisposed to low taxes and doesn't like the tax system to be used as a sort of social tool. But on green taxes and changing people's behaviour, they back the leadership on that.
Global markets soared yesterday after the US government bailout of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. We have more on why the Treasury finally took the plunge.
Freddie and Fannie were teetering close to the brink of collapse.
And as the new Pakistani president is sworn in, we hear about how he needs to balance his relationship with the West with the feelings of his own people.
The Pakistani population are largely and increasingly anti-Western and anti-American.
That's all coming up, but first, a summary of today's news and a quick flick through the papers.
Hurricane Ike is still sweeping across Cuba and is now heading for the United States. It's left major floods in Haiti, where bodies are reported to be floating in the streets. The death toll currently stands at over 300 people. Following yesterday's report by Human Rights Watch about a threefold increase in civilian deaths in the fighting in Afghanistan, NATO's tightened its rules of engagement there, ensuring more precise instructions. The USA has been asked to reopen an investigation into the alleged death of 90 civilians in an attack, which the Americans said only killed 20. And President Bush will announce the movement of 8,000 troops from Iraq to Afghanistan. Andy Murray has failed to beat Roger Federer in the final of the US Open Tennis Championships. He was beaten in three straight sets by the man who equaled the record of five straight wins in New York. Lawrence Donegan watched the match at Flushing Meadows. Tim Mabey asked him if it was a walkover.
Not quite a walkover, but certainly it was a fairly comprehensive. Federer, who many had written off as a guy whose time had passed, simply came out and played wonderfully well. In the circumstances, it's hard to see how Murray could have won him.
And was it a question of Federer being terribly subtle as against Murray's power, or what?
Murray's game is, you know, he's a very good tactical player. You know, he mixes up the angles, mixes up pace. The way it turned out was that it was Federer who was the guy who was playing the kind of clever tennis. You know, he had his opponent running around who was mixing up pace and combining that with just some brilliant winners, and he served really well. He didn't really have much of a chance.
Lawrence Donegan, and of course Murray, still wins $1 million. Both Gordon Brown and his Chancellor Alistair Darling faced their critics at the TUC today after the conference agreed to national demonstrations by civil servants after a payoff of below inflation. Mr Darling is going to promise to do everything possible to help families struggling with the big increase in prices, but he'll say he won't take unnecessary risks to provide short-term gains. The PM will face a hostile audience at dinner. And as a sign of more economic gloom led by the housing slump, the Institution of Chartered Surveyors reports today that estate agents are now selling on average just one property a week each. House prices continue to fall in 80% of the country, but surveyors say that more homes are now being put up for sale. Most front pages in the broadsheet papers carry the story of the liquid bomb plot, where three men were found guilty yesterday of conspiracy to commit mass murder. The Independent says they were turned into bombers while doing charity work in Pakistan. But The Guardian and The Times highlight the fact that the jury found them not guilty of planning to blow up passenger planes. The Times says that the police and prosecutors are in crisis after what they'd thought was the strongest terrorist case ever presented. The Guardian reports a survey of Tory party candidates. They're socially conservative, as you'd expect, and want tax breaks in favour of marriage and tighter controls on abortion. They want a reform of taxes, but they say that tax cuts can wait. We'll have more later in Guardian Daily. Most of the back pages carry pictures of Andy Murray playing in his US Open final. The Guardian has a thoughtful picture after his defeat. Otherwise, several go with the hunt for a new West Ham manager following Alan Kerbishley's walkout. Gianfranco Zola is being asked to come back to England. Keep up with these stories and all the news throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
The Guardian today publishes a survey of 66 prospective parliamentary candidates for the Conservatives, men and women who, if opinion polls are to be believed, may well take seats at the next election. The Guardian asked them about their feelings on a range of issues, from green taxes to marriage, to find out what kind of views may drive the party as it looks ahead to battling for power. I asked our political correspondent, Allegra Stratton, if the prospective MPs were all in the mould of David Cameron.
They are. I mean, they're very, very few of them, possibly only a handful of them went to Eton like David Cameron, but they certainly believe very similar things. They believe that they are socially conservative on the family. They believe in the importance of it. Sort of, you know, if you sort out the family, then lots of other problems in society will start to come together, which is a key new conservative way of thinking. They are very careful on tax cuts. Ordinarily, you'd have conservative parties sort of traditionally ideologically believe themselves to be the party of low taxation, and indeed in lots of the survey answers that you can see online, lots of them they do repeat this belief. They do say, we do believe in low taxes, but right now things are in such a bad way, it would be irresponsible to pledge anything. So they're very Cameroon in that sense, which is also a George Osborne thing. And then on Europe, they think that the UK has gained. Again, for many people listening, that's very different from Tory politicians of a generation ago, who sort of felt free to think exactly what they want and not be particularly coherent about that. And they're very environmentally friendly. A majority of them believe that green taxes are probably quite a good idea. So again, you have a Conservative Party that's ideologically predisposed to low taxes and doesn't like the tax system to be used as a sort of social tool. But on green taxes and changing people's behaviour, they back the leadership on that.
And what were the biggest surprises in the responses you got from these people?
I think that the discipline on tax is very impressive, because you do have quite a significant part of the conservative landscape who believe there should be tax cuts, have believed that their leadership should pledge tax cuts. And as the economy gets worse and worse, their sort of belief in the need for tax cuts, pledges on tax cuts, gets more and more vociferous rather than quiet.
And what about the family? David Cameron has really emphasised the issues of family and marriage. Where do they stand on that?
Well, they do support him. I mean, as with most things in this survey, they are loyal. But given they're loyal, it is really very interesting that there does seem to be, in various ways, a third of the candidates made an effort to say to us that though they support their leader in rebalancing the fiscal system so that marriage gets some kind of recognition, which it doesn't at the moment, and it's one of the only European countries that doesn't, a third of them did make the effort. It wasn't incorporated in the question. They went out on a limb to say that though they thought marriage should get a recognition, they didn't want to discriminate against single parents or against those people who cohabit and have lived together for 20 years and raised children but have just chosen not to get married. Why shouldn't they get the same kind of financial support?
So would you say now that we're starting to get a real sense of what the new Conservative Party actually believes in?
I think we're starting to get a sense of how disciplined they are and how much they want power and how near they think it is. It is difficult because, I mean, for instance, on that last point about the family, even though we know that Cameron wants this rebalancing so that marriage is recognised, we still don't know the exact form of their family fund, this pot of money that into which money raised from something like green tax will go. From these policies, we can put together that they are disciplined on tax, they are actually quite pro-European, but think things need to be sorted out as regards Lisbon and federal tendencies of Europe. They are quite environmentally friendly, but on other things, on the texture of it, it's still vague, and that's because the party is in many ways.
Allegra Stratton on the future of the Tories. But they're not in power yet, and a cabinet meeting held in Birmingham yesterday was the Labour government's latest demonstration that it is in touch with the people and wants to hear their views. For the first time since 1921, cabinet ministers met outside London or Chequers, and in addition to their own meeting, they also met members of the public to help them find out how policies made in London affect real people. Given the flagging popularity of Labour, one might brush this away day off as a gimmick. But, as The Guardian's Michael White told me, ministers were at pains to stress that it wasn't.
Well, ministers were very sensitive yesterday in insisting, no, of course it's not a gimmick. It's a genuine fact-finding mission. And certainly some of the people who came out of the hall, having been involved in these roundtable discussions, I spoke to several who said, yes, it was a good thing. They were rather upbeat about it. Brilliant, said a woman running a business development agency for women. Community workers said, well, you know, it's nice that they take the trouble to come and have face-to-face discussions. So we shouldn't be too cynical. On the other hand, Birmingham's an important political city. The Tories run the council these days. Labour did for many, many years. And there are lots of marginal seats here. So it cuts both ways, of course it does.
Do you see this as the beginning of the relaunch of Gordon Brown after the summer and the beginning of the party conference season and so on?
Well, I wouldn't overemphasize this word relaunch. Political journalists reach for it far too often. Brown's just got to slog it out, and he's got to hope he's got a chance of winning, that the tide will turn in his favor, and that events in the world, like yesterday's nationalization of those two big American housing corporations, that makes Northern Rock look pretty small beer, that that will help to improve the climate and get the credit crunch and other bad things over. That's his only hope, really, because otherwise he's going to get blamed. Rightly or wrongly, he's going to get blamed, and he knows it. He's an experienced finance minister, and this meeting in Birmingham was really saying to voters, trying to say to voters, look, we are listening. We know you're concerned. We know what you're worried about, the price of oil, the price of food, the price of money. One of the people I spoke to coming to the meeting said the mood was very one of humility inside. They know they're in trouble. And as a result, ministers were sent all around the city. Ed Balls went to schools, and the Culture Secretary, Andy Burnham, went next door to the conference centre, to the Birmingham Rep, famous theatre. And these guys learn things from this. They learn things in their constituencies, but not all their constituencies are the same. They learn from meeting other people in other places. So not a waste of time. I'm not sure whether it was worth all the effort that went into it. Certainly not a waste of time.
But going back to Gordon Brown and his problems, he came in for some quite strong criticism at the TUC Congress yesterday too, didn't he?
Well, you can't get away from this if you're in Brown's position. Yes, he was criticised at the TUC. I suspect they thought he was big-footing them a bit by staging this session in Birmingham on the first day of their conference. And equally, ministers, whenever they got near a camera, people said, do you support Gordon Brown? Ed Ball said he was a bit like Obama or John McCain. They were the underdogs a year ago. And David Miliband said, you know, he's more determined and vigorous than he was. He could surprise everybody by winning. Most interesting was John Hutton, asked if he supported the Prime Minister, said, I support his work. Ooh-hoo. I didn't hear that myself, but it's been reported in the newspapers. So you can't get away from the shadow of uncertainty. And when the trade union leaders say to Labour MPs, make your mind up, get rid of him or back him, well, even by saying that, they're highlighting the weakness of Mr. Brown's position at the moment. It's not, in my view, completely beyond repair, but every day that passes, it certainly gets harder.
Michael White there. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, with warnings of more dire weather to come, we have video of the storms in northeast England and a Q&A on what to do if your house gets flooded. That's at guardian.co.uk/news. At guardian.co.uk/comment is free. Julian Borgia asks whether the EU really has the diplomatic clout to get taken seriously in Moscow. And at guardian.co.uk/books, the book a shortlist as it happens, with news, blogs and audio from Britain's biggest literary prize.
From guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
Global markets soared yesterday in response to the American government's bailout of the giant mortgage lenders Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. The two companies account for half of all mortgages in the US and have struggled to remain solvent over the past year after bearing the brunt of the subprime crisis. The bailout, like that of Northern Rock in the UK, is in effect nationalisation, though supposedly for a limited period. The US government will inject $100 billion into the companies to allow them to keep trading. I asked economics correspondent Ashley Seeger why markets all over the world had reacted so positively to the news.
Well, I think markets hate uncertainty, and they'd been worried about Freddie and Fannie for some time because the two institutions were clearly in trouble. And Henry Paulson had taken powers in July to make this move, and it means that the government has extended its lender of last resort facility ultimately to the entire US mortgage market. It means US mortgage rates should fall. It's an encouraging step, if you like, if you're a bank that hasn't been able to lend any mortgages for a long time and are worried about not doing any business. This ends a great deal of that uncertainty. That's why, you know, stock prices in banks have soared everywhere around the world.
This was obviously a huge step for the American government to take. What might have happened if they hadn't done it?
Well, I think Freddie and Fannie were teetering close to the brink of collapse. They are institutions that arguably have run their course and shouldn't exist any longer, and for certain won't exist in anything like the form they are now once they come out of conservatorship, as it's called. So there was a very real danger that they would collapse, and that would bring down, really bring down, the financial system in the US and probably around the world as well, since so many banks globally hold these mortgage-backed securities that we've heard so much about during the credit crunch.
And US Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson had battled to prevent this happening. How much of an embarrassment is it to the government?
Is it an embarrassment? I don't know that it's an embarrassment, really. Certainly there were figures that came out on Friday about the extent of arrears and foreclosures in American mortgages that were so bad that I think they were probably the final straw that made the government act. They were really awful numbers on Friday. And I think the government just thought, we've got to act. You could say it's 3 months before an election. You could be cynical. But for certain, you wouldn't want, as Treasury Secretary Paulson knows, that if Obama wins, he's only got 3 or 4 months left in power. So I think he didn't want to be the man who saw Freddie and Fannie collapse on his watch, if you like.
And speaking of Obama and John McCain, one of them will be president. The Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson briefed them about what he was doing. How did they react?
Well, McCain said he was positive about it and it had to be done. Obama said he would reserve judgment to see whether taxpayers were protected. They do look protected, I must say. It's shareholders that have been wiped out in this. The government has essentially taken over these two bodies for nothing. There are signs that the American housing market is bottoming out. If it increases and business picks up for Freddie and Fannie, then the taxpayer will sit on a very healthy profit potentially in a year or two. So while Obama is right to be worried about taxpayers, we don't want taxpayers to pay for the folly of these lending institutions. But it does look like they may come out of it okay.
And looking ahead, this conservatorship, as you mentioned, in effect temporary nationalisation, supposed to be temporary, how easy will it be for the government to return Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae to the private sector?
Well, that will depend on the health of the housing market, and that this move is designed to sort of put a floor, as I mentioned, under prices. So it will depend to a great extent on how quickly financial markets more generally and the US housing market in particular return to some sort of normal state. But there's no doubt that Freddie and Fannie will not return to the private sector in the form that they were taken in from the private sector in it. They were an anomaly, an anachronism. They should have been got rid of years ago. They were just so big that they could employ the best lobbyists in Washington to keep them alive. But really, in a world of big, broad capital markets, there's no need for these kind of institutions. We don't have them in Britain, and you don't have them generally elsewhere in the world. We won't see Freddie and Fannie in the same condition, the same state again. They are finished, essentially, as they were. They've died, in a way.
Ashley Seeger, and of course you can read more on that story at guardian.co.uk. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, would Abu Dhabi have been satisfied with any old football club?
Do you know anything about Manchester City? Have you ever heard of them?
I don't know much about it, no, to be honest. But it's a common game here. People start playing football since childhood.
But first, in Pakistan, Asif Ali Zardari, husband of the assassinated former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, is being sworn in as president today. He will have to balance the demands of the United States in the war against terror against the feelings of his own people and try to pull Pakistan out of its economic slump. Zardari was elected by the political establishment and not the Pakistani people. And as John Dennis heard from The Observer's Jason Burke, ordinary Pakistanis are not that excited about their new president.
There's not much enthusiasm among the general Pakistani population for any politician. Of the politicians in Pakistan at the moment, Zardari is one of the least popular. He's seen as something of a chancer. The various allegations of corruption against him have stained his reputation. Many people remember the period in the 90s when Benazir Bhutto, his wife obviously, was in power, a period that was associated and is certainly associated in the popular memory with political instability, a degree of mismanagement, economic chaos and so forth. So overall, it's fair to say that he's hardly being welcomed with open arms.
He faces enormous challenges, of course. Islamist insurgents on the rise, economic problems. What hopes are there that he can bring stability to Pakistan and revive the economy?
Not many. It's certainly the case that Pakistan is always faced by a whole variety of difficult challenges and shows remarkable resilience. If you look at how many major shocks the state has absorbed in the last 18 months, numerous suicide bombs, the assassination of a major political figure, an effective legislative coup, etc., it's astonishing that you don't see more chaos than you actually do. A lot depends on the regional situation. A lot depends on Washington. Zardari's own room for manoeuvre is relatively limited given the strength of the military establishment in Pakistan. For the moment, the army are staying on the sidelines, watching, waiting, but there's no doubt that at some later date they'd be prepared to step in if they felt that Zardari was in some way threatening what they deem to be the national security interests of Pakistan.
Last week, US troops based in Afghanistan crossed the border into Pakistan to carry out raids on what they said were Taliban targets. Will Zardari allow a repeat of that?
Zardari is in a very difficult position. He needs to please Washington because he needs the money that Washington are paying the Pakistani army and the economic aid they're delivering. He needs their support at the IMF, the World Bank. Every place he's going to be going to beg for economic help in the months that are coming. At the same time, the Pakistani population are largely and increasingly anti-Western and anti-American. And like any nation, most people don't take too kindly to troops from another country crossing onto their land for whatever reason. So he's in a very difficult position. He's got to tread a very, very tight path between pleasing the international community or largely the West and cooperating in the way that they want him to cooperate in the war on terror and risking popular wrath, if you like, in being seen to be, as General Musharraf, his predecessor, eventually was, a stooge of the West.
And that was Jason Burke talking to John Dennis. Now, the sale of Manchester City to the Abu Dhabi royal family has caused some British football fans to worry that the club has become a bauble in a grotesque game of fantasy football. The Guardian's Robert Booth went to Abu Dhabi to investigate the new owners' claims that they want the purchase to enhance the reputation of the United Arab Emirates and boost football in the Gulf.
In Manchester, all the talk might be of what the sheikhs can do for Manchester City Football Club, but here in Abu Dhabi, 3,500 miles away, that perspective is reversed. The purchase of City is just part of a lightning-fast development strategy that is economic, cultural, as well as sporting. But during daylight hours at least, what's really on people's minds here is Ramadan, the strictly observed fast. Between dawn and dusk, the faithful don't eat and they don't drink, not even water. And that means it's not until after iftar, the moment the daily fast ends, that the Emiratis can turn their minds to their sheikh's latest venture. I've come to a Ramadan tent at one of Abu Dhabi's many luxury hotels. It's located on a beach and people are smoking shisha pipes, snacking on nuts and sipping mint tea after the fast. So what do you make of the acquisition in terms of Abu Dhabi's status in the world?
I think it's more like a kind of branding for the UAE in general. They've been doing acquisitions and to build up a brand for the UAE internationally.
And how does football fit into that?
Football is like any big games, okay? It builds up the name of the UAE because it's very well known internationally.
And why does the UAE feel a need to do that?
They don't need as such, but it's part of the growth they are doing to become international standards and they have the capital of the UAE, mainly it's Abu Dhabi, yeah. Versus, for example, Dubai. You feel like they are competing against each other. Dubai is doing so many things, so Abu Dhabi should do also the same, something like this.
Yeah. Do you know anything about Manchester City? Have you ever heard of them?
I don't know much about it, no, to be honest, but I've heard of it. That's it. It's a common game here. People start playing football since childhood.
I've been here over than 20 years. I've been here since 75. And I've seen this country goes from a couple of streets and a desert into this beautiful country. Abu Dhabi is unique. It is safe. It is comfortable. It's easy to live in.
Abu Dhabi is a boom town like few others, but the courtiers and the government officials that I've spoken to here are keen to stress that money is not thrown around with abandon here. In fact, they are a little embarrassed that that is how the deal to buy Manchester City may have come across in the UK. And they say that the football club, which costing about £200 million is far from expensive for their deep pockets, is in truth part of a strategy of improving the country's international standing through football. Most importantly, they hope that owning Man City can help the national team, the United Arab Emirates team, which is under pressure to qualify for the 2010 World Cup in South Africa.
Robert Booth reporting from Abu Dhabi. And that's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 a.m. Producing today, Ian Chambers and Tim Mabey. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.